Hello, I'm Vantone Quinlevin, CEO of Futuro Health, welcoming you to Workforce RX, where I interview leaders and innovators for insights into creating a future-ready workforce. That describes today's guest perfectly because Dr. Angela Jackson is a nationally recognized authority on the future of work, and her research has helped redefine traditional approaches to human capital. Her reputation will surely grow as a result of her brand new book, The Win-Win Workplace: How Thriving Employees Drive Bottom-Line Success. The book is based in part on her experiences as CEO of Future Forward Strategies, a firm which provides labor market intelligence to businesses to help them unlock organizational potential. When she's not busy with that work, she is lecturing at Harvard University and writing for leading journals, including the Harvard Business Review and Stanford Social Innovation Review. Regular listeners, you may recall that we talked to Angela 2 years ago in episode 51 about reimagining employee benefits and the social determinants of work. And I'm delighted to welcome you back to the program, Angela.
Vaughn, I'm excited to be back here, and thank you again for the invitation.
Yes, welcome back, and congratulations on publishing your first book. What prompted you to write it, and how do you describe it in a nutshell?
You know, I can't believe it's been 2 years since we've been in conversation with each other, but I'd like to say back when I was talking to you before, I talked about the initiative I led around the Future of Work Grand Challenge. This book, The Win-Win Workplace, actually stems from that research. I got really curious about the people we were able to place in living wage jobs with the Future of Work Grand Challenge, and this was during the pandemic. I got curious about when these employees were placed, which ones were thriving and which ones weren't. And when I began to follow up with them 6 months later, 12 months later, I found some people, again, had started at maybe entry-level positions. Some of them had moved up. Some of them were even going into management, where I'd go to another set of workplaces, and people had already stopped out. They had left, or they were thinking about leaving. And what I began to see develop was this pattern around the places where employees were thriving. You know, I saw investments around centering worker voice. I saw that the leadership and companies were doing deep training, not just for the skills for today, but really looking around the corner, seeing the skills of tomorrow. And Vaughn, what I really found curious is that many of these thriving workplaces had a very specific initiative around measuring this. So they were using data and analytics in a way to drive their decisions around their people investments and also the programs they had. And they could actually tell you how those had a correlation to lift on the bottom line.
Ooh, I cannot wait to dive into these topics because I know retention has been a particularly important topic, especially in the healthcare area. So, Angela, one of your central recommendations is that the workplaces actively listen to employee feedback and incorporate it into decision making because it creates a culture of trust and inclusion. So we'd love for you to share some example of how you've seen that play out successfully in the workplace. And I understand you brought 200 employers recently together in a win-win summit to discuss this.
Yeah, we had the Win-Win Workplace Summit in Chicago. We had 200 employees, and one through line through all of them is that they were centering employee voices. And so when I say that, Vaughn, you know, most CEOs or leaders say, of course we listen to our employees. I mean, it's in fact a $1 billion industry. But what we found out through our research is that while we were asking employees lots of questions, many of them, and this is a stat today, most workers will tell you that they don't feel that their employers care about them. So while we're asking questions, my insight from the research was we weren't asking the questions on what mattered most to the actual employees. And those thriving workplaces I saw, which I call win-win workplaces in the book, they would ask questions to employees about what are the barriers for you getting to work? You know, what are the benefits that matter most to you? What are your ideas around how we could save money or we could make more money? And they weren't just reserving those conversations to the highest wage earners. They were doing that at all levels of the organization. And what was fascinating about that is that when employees were actually asked and listened to, they gave answers, answers that were driving the business. And I'll tell you a quick story because I write about it in chapter 1 of the book. There was a CHI door company, door manufacturer, manufacturer in the Midwest in Illinois, new management came in and they were told the employees up front, they said, you know, we'd like to make this company profitable in the next 4 to 6 years. If we make this company profitable, you're going to share in those profits, but we need your ideas. And so they asked employees rank and file, how can we be more efficient? And there was one delivery driver was like, I'm glad you asked. He was like, I've been given this route, you know, on a GPS. I'm holding up my iPhone and it's the wrong way. It takes longer than I know a shorter cut. I've grown up in this town and I know this. And not only did they listen to him, but they asked that same question to all of the drivers. And lo and behold, what they found was the drivers were right. There were shorter routes that were not picked up by GPS. And it actually, in turn, made them more productive in terms of on-time deliveries. The other thing I say, and I thought was evident from the conversations, when you went back and talked to those actual drivers, they're like, finally, someone listened. I've been saying this for years, but they're telling me be quiet and drive. What that opened up in those conversations were other opportunities for workers to actually share their ideas because they felt like they were actually going to be heard, considered, and acted on. And it was a real powerful lever when you think about, especially in this moment, when companies are trying to think about how they can be, you know, more effective, more profitable against the current headwinds, really listening to employees at all levels, thinking that they're experts at their position and where they are in the company, and that they have value that they can add by bringing to some of the business and the strategy.
Well, I was wondering if you could just give some advice on what systems need to be set up to capture that employee input. And kind of a part two is, I'm sure a lot of employers experience where once the employees give the input, they expect it to be acted on. So where's the balance between kind of giving voice, but also figuring out how to prioritize what to act on?
And that's a very good question. So in all of these companies, and these were small companies to large companies, I want to share, the listening was using current platforms that employers already ask. The biggest thing is making sure you're asking the right questions. So really understanding from that employee's perspective, what are the barriers to work? What are the ideas that they have from their seat that could help the company? And the second piece of it that I saw was the insight is the closing of the loop. So many times we ask for ideas, even if it's as small as a suggestion box and someone's putting it on a post-it note, we don't close the loop. We don't go back and say, this is what we heard. This is what we can do. This is what we can't do right now, or this is what we won't be able to do, and let us bring you into the thinking. That closing of the loop is huge. And I write about this in a story in chapter 9 of a book with the CEO of Stone Age. It's an employee-owned company. And the CEO, Carrie Siggins, talks about this. She goes, you know, when she first embarked on this, it was scary to ask people their opinions because she goes, you know, what if I can't do it all? What if I have to tell them no? What's going to happen? And one thing that she said that I see across leadership that's actually leaning in and asking rank and file employees about their ideas is that when you close the loop, they may not understand the reason why, or they may not agree with it, but they can respect that you actually close the loop. And when I meant they may not understand, I had an actual worker tell me that. He goes, you know, I just appreciate that they took the time to come back to me and tell me the reason why. For so many times, I see decisions made and I'm not even brought into the thinking on that. And that's what I talk about in the book too, Vaughn, is just mutual respect. How do we build relationships across that and treat people like they are adults? Most adults know when they're coming to the workplace, you're not going to be able to do it all. But when you bring them into your thinking, they feel respected. And that's one key pattern that we saw in all of those thriving win-win workplaces. There was a level of respect and kind of mutualistic relationships that were present.
I'm curious, Angela, because the concept of employee feedback and, you know, engagement committee or other types of committee to improve processes, for example, they're not new concepts, but is there a heightened expectation in our workforce these days to be able to have voice? Are you seeing that pattern?
Yeah, they're not new concepts, but what I'd push on here is that, do we really listen to them? I'm going to give you a quick example. I was working with a client and they stood up a group of younger professionals because they have a 5-generation workforce. And they said, we're going to get a new generation committee and we're going to ask for their advice, how we should think about, you know, hiring, how we should think about implementing programs. And this committee met over 6 months and they came up with a set of 8 to 9 recommendations that they'd like to see implemented. The CHRO at the time, you know, looked at those recommendations. He took them back to the management and they decided that they weren't going to do any of them. And in fact, they were going to go against one of the recommendations. And so what the CHRO did is he went back to him and said, I know that you spent, you know, the last 6 months looking at this. You gave us, you know, 8 to 9 recommendations. In fact, we're going to do something completely opposite. And he said, because that's what management has decided. That happens so often. And what that does in the process is it erodes trust. You don't have the respect that's there, and you've not really explained it. It's almost like because we said so. And so all of that good work that they had done, this company would tell you they deeply listened, and they did for 6 to 8 months. But then with one decision, they eroded all of that good work. And so the point that we're trying to make in this book is those companies, even when the decisions are hard, even if they have to go a different direction, they're giving employees an audience. They're not saying because I said so. They're bringing them to the thinking. They're telling them why it's a financial decision or why in this moment, why it might be a political decision. And there's some hard decisions being made every day. And it's the way we go about making those decisions and communicating them that makes all the difference.
I was wondering if you could coach us a little bit on how to effectively close the loop, especially if the what is being implemented is different from what the recommendation is or some hybrid solution in between.
I'm going to give you a real world example that a lot of folks are facing right now. We know with the current administration, a lot of DEI programs are being eliminated. And so one company that had many different kind of ERG groups, and we see a lot of employees have employee resource groups. And these are affinity groups that are along, you know, lines of identity. So it could be working parents. It could be the Black Employee Resource Group. It could be the care group for people with, you know, young children. And what this organization did, it centered employee voices, and the employees wanted them to create these employee resource groups so they could meet with other employees who have shared identities, shared challenges, to be able to support each other, to help each other, to navigate the world of not only work, but also life. And so this company had 80% of federal contracts, and they received a letter and said, if you don't move away from these programs, you're going to lose these contracts. That's 80% of the organization's funding. And so the CHRO was like, this is a terrible dilemma. She deeply believes in diversity, equity, and inclusion. She was a champion. A lot of these programs came from the rank and file. They had done listening. They were employee-centered. They were thriving. But she was faced in the management with a real dilemma. If 80% of their funding comes from government contracts, and this administration says, if you keep these programs, even though the employee said, we're going to take away 80% of that funding, they could have said no to the administration, but the choice was that they would have to eliminate a lot of jobs in doing so. And so what they went back to the rank and file and said, this is what we have to do. We don't like it either. But this is the choice we have. Either we change these programs or we're going to have to lay off a large percentage of the company. What should we do? And so in that moment, in bringing them together, what happened in that company, and I've watched this and it's really powerful, they've come together around this. They come together and said, even though it's not going to be labeled diversity, equity, and inclusion, we still believe in belonging. We still value every employee, and they've come out of it stronger versus management being in its own silo, making decisions that they think are more paternalistic or what's best for the employees. They brought them in together and said, okay, what's the core reason we were doing these programs in the first place? How do we make sure we maintain the spirit of that and everything that we built, even in the face of these political headwinds?
Oh, that's a really good example and so cogent to all of us who are running organizations. So, Angela, in your opening comment, you suggested that employers should treat investments in people with the same rigor as investments in product development or sales by having metrics. Tell us more about what you mean.
So there's this whole business out there, Vaughn, around people analytics. And what's been interesting about that is that we know that employers have a lot of data about their people. But as I sit in many boardrooms, as I sit in many C-suites, how many times are those people analytics looked at with the regular cadence that you look at product sales or service sales? And so what we're trying to put forth and what we saw in the win-win workplaces is that they put the effort and the measurement that they would do with a product and service into their human people. And so when you say that human capital is the most valuable resource, how often are we talking about it? Are we measuring it just once a year? Are we doing it, you know, once a quarter? Are we actually looking more frequently around monthly? As we see what's happened from the pandemic, we know that headwinds are changing drastically. Have we checked in with our people to know how this is impacting them day to day? We hear about tariffs. How is that impacting the ability for your workforce to buy that new car that they need to go to work? What does that mean when they're going to the grocery store, but we haven't given them a raise since last year? You know, knowing the health of your employees and how they're faring inside and outside the work has a really big impact on your business. And what we saw with these win-win workplaces is that they knew the metrics, and all the metrics weren't the same. What the C-suite leaders did was they identified 2 to 3 metrics that were really important for them to know if their workforce was healthy. You know, they wanted to make sure that they knew that people were healthy outside. They want to know that they were financially in good shape, being able to work. They want to know that if they were caregiving or their health was healthy. And this is something they talked about on a regular basis. Up there with one of those metrics were training. How did they ensure that their incumbent workforce were trained for the jobs that they know that they would need in the future? And how many people were trained? How many people did they need to train? These were on a dashboard that you see. And one example, and this was a great presentation that someone from Santa Fe Pharmaceuticals gave. Her name was Kathleen Maddy. She showed us at the Win-Win Summit a dashboard where they're tracking these metrics on a weekly basis, checking in with their people. She's able to type in one fell swoop, who is everyone who's trained on SaaS? And she can pull up the number of people down to the name who's trained. She knows how many people aren't trained. So if there's a new technology that they're planning to leverage, she's able to see who in the workplace is doing it, who's ready, how frequently were they trained, how recent was the training. And this is what I'm talking about in terms of people analytics. How do you know about their well-being and health, but also how do you know who they are and how they've changed over the tenure of the organization, so you can actually use that information. And that's what these companies are doing, Bon. They're using this information to drive their business decisions, and that's how they're able to track the ROI of these programs, of the trainings, of the programs they have around well-being, because they know how they're driving bottom line outputs.
Well, you mentioned employee well-being, and of course, that's so much more front and center ever since the pandemic. And what are some key measures along employee well-being?
So the big one that we look at is just health. We want to understand who's taking advantage of health benefits. How many people aren't taking advantage of health benefits? I was working with a hospitality company that was based in Brooklyn, and they came because as we begin to look at their metrics, although they offered health insurance, what they saw is that their younger demographic was not taking advantage of it. And they want to lean in to understand more. What were they doing if they were not taking advantage of this? What was happening when they were getting sick? Where were they actually going? And what they found out is that these younger emerging professionals couldn't afford the benefit. And so they rather went without it. And what this company was able to do once they learned that, they were able to create a different type of plan so that these individuals would actually have access to health benefits. And they did this via telemedicine. What they wanted to make sure is that if someone got sick, they weren't just staying at home being sick, that they could actually get the medical attention that they needed. And this is the health that I'm talking about. So many employers, again, we have this data. We know how many people are participating in the plan. We need to get curious why people aren't participating in the plan and making sure that they get the help that they need if we're going to actually have a healthy workforce that's able to show up and be engaged in work.
That's another good example that you just shared. And you had talked about the training dashboard, who's ready, who's completed training, how recent was it? You had made another core point in the book, which is the value of building equitable pathways to advancement. And would you elaborate a little bit on that goal and what can be done to remove barriers?
Yeah, absolutely. In the book, and it's chapter 7, we call it building a deep talent bench. And what we're seeing in this moment now is when I'm talking to CEOs out there, and I, you know, researched over 1,700 companies for this book, and I'm talking to CEOs, C-teams, you know, multiple times a week. I'm going to say the quiet thing out loud. People aren't talking about hiring right now. Things are tight. There's a wait and see approach. And so what that's a forcing mechanism is that people and companies are looking at their incumbent workforce and saying, how can they do more? how can we think about training them? And that's the good part of it, right? Is that they are looking at the incumbent workforce in a different way and seeing the value there. The challenge is, for so long, we haven't followed people. When people come in, they give us a resume. We know what they did when they got hired, but we've not stayed in touch to say, how have they reskilled? Did they get a certificate? Did they take a class? We haven't really invested in those mechanisms to see how people have grown over their tenure. Some of the best companies that we saw, and Sanofi is one of them, they're checking in with their employees regularly and incentivizing them to talk about what they've learned, what community college class, what Coursera class, what experience they had, because they understand as their employees are growing within their job and even outside, all that skills and expertise can be brought to bear for the business. And that's what we're seeing in this next wave of people analytics. It's just not about collecting data. It's really thinking about in this new world of work where new opportunities and job roles are being created every day, that we understand what our deep talent bench looks like. We know who's on C-suite today, but who's next up? Who's at the front lines that is learning and growing that we should keep our eye on? Not because they're socially connected or they're good at water cooler talk, because actually they're putting in the work to grow. And so having that data to use to inform the business decisions makes all the difference. And that's why these companies, frankly, Vaughn, are more profitable. They have higher retention because people feel like they're being seen. That their expertise and the fact that they go out and learn new skills is being valued, and that they're being systematically promoted because of that.
So, Angela, a lot of companies are wrestling, as you mentioned, with that practical example of the employee resource group and DEI. And that example was about the company having 80% of its revenues coming from federal contracts. As you are thinking about the major pushback on DEI initiatives, what advice do you have for us listeners?
So I'm probably going to say something a bit controversial here, Vaughn, but for me, you know, DEI, I'm never going to fall on the sword of an acronym. When I go back and we go back to what was the real intention behind DEI in the workplace, it was really created so people could actually show up, you know, fully and give their best self to their job. Why? Because that's better for the company. And so when we think about looking around the corner, that's ever more important today. That people can show up and that we're addressing the barriers that they have to work. And I just want to just make this very plain. I live here in Massachusetts and we've got some of the worst traffic in the world. We have the most expensive housing and we're losing a lot of our young professionals because they can't afford to live here. They can't find workforce housing. And this is at all levels. I'm not talking about, you know, non-traditional talent. I'm talking about traditionally middle-class folks who can't afford to live here. I'm talking about middle-class folks who, you know, worst traffic in the country, taking them 2 hours to get to work, that they're spending upwards of 30% of their after-tax income on transportation. These are real realities. And when we're talking about the win-win workplace, what we're seeing companies do is shift the paradigm. In the past, we'd say, well, I give you a paycheck. You figure the rest of that out. You know, you've got to get to work. I'm giving you a paycheck. What we're seeing with these win-win companies, they're saying, we understand that wages are not rising like inflation. What else can we do to ensure that our employees can be really engaged in work? There's one company that we have here that's called Zillow. What they're offering and a couple of companies they work with is transportation as a benefit. So think about the transportation buses you see in Silicon Valley, but they're doing that for rank and file employees. Those who can pay more, those who can pay less. But what they're recognizing and what they're signaling to their workforce is, we see you. We know that this is an impediment to getting in the job, and we want to work shoulder to shoulder to make sure that you can get here. And when we talk about the win-win workplace, this is what we're going to need more of. These are the companies where you're going to see higher retention because they feel like they're being taken care of. And what we're hoping for, and I write about in this book, is a reimagining of that social contract today and what that means in the day of AI, agentic AI, you know, tariffs, et cetera. We still need to know and understand deeply, what does it take for someone to get to work? They need to be healthy. They need to be able to go to the doctor. They need transportation. They need safe housing that's not 3 hours away from their work, because then they're worried about their kids if they have to go home in an emergency and that happens. And they need flexibility. And so if you see employers who are looking at those old playbooks where, like, you have to come in, you know, no excuses, three strikes, you're out. two things are going to happen. And one of my students at Harvard just asked me that, and I won't name the company, but he said he turned down a job 3 times with them, but he was going to have to take it because he has college loans. I said, but how long are you going to stay? He was like, I'm not staying. I'm trying to find the next job as soon as I can get it. They're going to lose the A players because A players will always have optionality. Two, they're going to have a workforce that comes in sick and afraid. My colleagues at Harvard put out a report a few weeks ago. They said that people with a critical illness, 32% of them in the workforce today have missed a critical doctor's appointment. How can someone who has a critical illness miss a doctor's appointment and you expect that person to be productive? Yeah, you know, we're sleeping at the will if we think that's true. So those old playbooks, we're going to see companies still operate with them, but they're going to lose their A players. They're going to see people who are building new companies and reimagining work surpass them. And we're already seeing that right now. And so I'm just encouraging people to, one, look at these practices, not because it's theory or it feels good. What we put in this book is we looked at real case studies, real ROI, and talked about increased share price. We talked about sales. We talked about increased productivity. The companies and the case studies in this book, it's not fluffy. It's not soft. These are real hard numbers. And the more and more when you're looking at defined value for companies and you're looking like, how can I get my share price up by even 50 cents? These things begin to matter at scale and they are in our control.
I am so glad you have put out that call to action to move from the old playbooks to the new playbooks and that you have written your first book, The Win-Win Workplace. Where can our listeners find a copy of your book?
The book is available wherever books are sold. They can go to readwinwinworkplace.com. On that site, we're evolving it too. The case studies that we mentioned in the book, we're creating even more case studies. We're also introducing a community of practice around this. As I mentioned at the top of our conversation, we had 200 employers show up. There are a set of workplaces, despite all the headlines we're hearing, that are doubling down on their investments in people, and they're reaping those kind of bottom line inputs, and they want to be in community with each other to share practices. You know, they're not worried about losing their employees. They're more concerned with when they come back. And that's what the win-win workplace is about. It's treating people good. It's investing in them. It's having those people, your workers, most valuable employees, return, you know, shareholder price, profitability. And if they leave and go somewhere else and they come back because you're a good workplace, it's a win for everybody. And that's what this new world of work, I hope, looks like in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Angela Jackson, for being with us today as one of our few two-timers on this podcast. We're so delighted to have you and see the fruits of all of your research and your writing.
Oh, I'm honored, Vaughn, anytime, and I can't wait to see you hopefully in person soon. You take care.
That would be great. I'm Vaughn Tone Quinlivan with Futuro Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in America.